This is What's It Like with Dr. Ken Tangen.
Hi, I'm Ken Tangen. This is episode 36 of What's It Like. My guest is Kirk Harnack from Nashville, Tennessee, the singing star, country music legend. Well, at least radio guy.
That's right.
How long have you been in radio?
You know, I've been in radio since, here you go. I've been in radio since just after I stopped stuttering as a child. Seriously, I had a terrible speech impediment. When I was a child, radio would have been the last thing that I could do because I really did have a profound stutter. I couldn't say my name without sounding like Mel Tillis. I don't know if any of your students will know Mel Tillis, but I had a profound stutter. In fact, I stuttered so badly that the teachers in school would never call on me to read aloud. They would ask me to do the sound effects for a story that the class was reading. So, I grew up with that and being very bashful and shy and not being able to talk very well or to talk in a way that, you know, the kids made fun of. That was quite a tough thing. So, naturally, I wanted to get into radio.
So how did you make that transition?
You know, it's interesting. I went through a speech therapy, and at the time that I was growing up in the late 60s and early 1970s, the theory at the time was I stuttered because I was ambidextrous. And, you know, I used my left and right hands about equally. And they thought at the time that was a theory. I don't think that theory is in vogue anymore. So I went actually through a lot of physical therapy to help me be whatever hand that I wanted to be, and I wanted to be left-handed. I did tend to favor that a little bit. So I became left-handed, and I think it helped a little bit. It gave me some mechanisms or some physical crutches to use to not stammer as much. By the way, did you know that if you stutter, you only stutter when you talk? You don't stutter when you sing, and you don't stutter if you whisper. So you can whisper just fine, never stutter. You know?
Isn't that odd?
So anyway, this terrible impediment that really screwed up my self-image and my confidence, I quit stuttering about the same time that girls quit having cooties.
That's an interesting timing.
Yes, because I think I figured out, you know, these girls, they're kind of nice. I'd kind of like to get to know one of them, but this stuttering just won't do. So I don't know the day or the time that I got over it, but it was probably about seventh or eighth grade, or I think by ninth grade, I was pretty well over it. And by the time I went into high school, I was doing a little bit of work in radio.
Did you have siblings?
Yes. And in fact, one of them stuttered as well. But not for very long, and I think she didn't even have a lot of physical therapy and speech therapy, and she came out of it just fine. So I don't know much about that. It's behind me, and I would encourage anybody who is a stutterer, or if you know one, there's hope. Mm-hmm. There's hope. I only now I only stutter when I'm lying.
Well, good thing you're not a politician. Then,
there you go. There you go. I'd be stuttering a lot.
Let me ask you this. What's it like living in Nashville?
Nashville's a wonderful, beautiful city. I don't think we're a rich city. We do okay. We depend a lot on tourism. The music industry employs a lot of people. There's the music industry. The country music industry, of course, is very big here. Believe it or not, the health insurance industry is pretty big here. Now, some people, you know, don't like that. Some people do. Whether you do or not, it's a good size industry here. And the third thing that actually has come about in about the last 15 years is Nashville is the home of the contemporary Christian music industry. So you've got people like Michael W. Smith, who's very popular in those circles. People like Jackie Velasquez, she's very big in the Christian music industry. So you've got a lot of that going on here. And there's some crossover. You've got some country artists and Christian artists that cross back and forth. It's also home of I found out, apparently, you know that kids cartoon VeggieTales?
Oh, yes.
They do that here in Nashville. Oh. And the voices are local people here in Nashville that do the voices of, you know, Larry the Cucumber or whatever it is. So there's an enormous amount of creativity that goes on here in Nashville. And that's cool. I'm just delighted to see that. Of course, there's recording studios. My next door neighbor actually has a recording studio in his house. He does music beds for various productions. He writes those himself and does that. But you can't swing a guitar and throw it without hitting a musician. And you run across musicians here. And in fact, the house I live in, the very house I live in, was owned by a guy named Otis Blackwell. Now, a lot of folks have never heard of Otis Blackwell. Have you ever heard of him?
No.
No, see? I never heard of Otis Blackwell. Well, it turns out there's a lot of folks that never actually heard of Otis Blackwell, but he wrote a few songs you've heard of. I live in the house that was Otis Blackwell lived in. He wrote Love Me Tender. He wrote Don't Be Cruel, by that Elvis Presley sang. He wrote Great Balls of Fire that Jerry Lee Lewis sang. He wrote a song for Patsy Cline. It's not coming to you right now. He wrote the song Handyman that James Taylor made famous. Hey, baby, I'm your handyman. You know that one. He wrote all these songs. Otis Blackwell was a black man from Brooklyn, New York. And he was a very prolific songwriter. And unfortunately, being a black man coming up in the 50s and 60s, he did not get a very good deal on a lot of his efforts. It wasn't until later in life that he started to get paid properly for the music that he wrote. And by the way, on Elvis Records, on some of his songs, you'll see the writing credit that says Elvis Presley, Otis Blackwell. Mm-hmm. Elvis didn't have a thing to do with writing those songs.
That's not uncommon, is it?
It's not uncommon, but I don't think it's very fair. Hey, what's Otis to do? He needed the money.
Yep.
Okay, Colonel Parker, yeah, I'll share credit with Elvis as long as you pay me some cash for that song.
Yep.
And so anyway, Otis was a dear, dear man, and he loved country music. So he had a manager, actually, even as a writer, he had a manager in Nashville, and his manager persuaded him in the mid-70s to move to Nashville. And so he did, and he lived here until about 10 years ago, and passed away in this very house. So we were able to purchase it from his heirs, and just delighted to be here and kind of have that aura, that spell, mm-hmm. that Otis Blackwell, prolific songwriter, right? He wrote over 1,000 songs.
Does it make you want to write songs?
I wish, but my daughter sure does. She's written a couple songs. One was recorded, not professionally, but just for fun, by a budding artist.
Technology seems to change lots of things. How has it changed radio?
There are computer programs and services out there now that a station can subscribe to that you have a computer, and this computer receives data over the internet from the National Weather Service, and it looks for the forecast for your area, and it looks at the text, the actual text that makes up that forecast feed. It puts it into a text file, and then the computer program examines that text file and parses the words and phrases that are in that file. And then it compares those words and phrases with a library of up to 30,000 audio cuts. And these audio cuts will be little short snippets, some guy saying, in our area today, and then another snippet saying, partly cloudy skies, or mostly sunny skies, or a clear day today, and with a high of, and then you put, it'll put the temperature in. The bottom line is this, computer programs now are so sophisticated that you can make a forecast that sounds like a normal, natural human voice. It's not a mechanized voice.
You should certainly never trust anything that you hear now.
You can't. And, you know, actually, I'm friends with the guy who invented this technology. He sold it later to the Weather Channel. And then he moved out of the country and started the business all over again. But if you listen to his forecast, it sounds very natural. He'll say, like, in our area today, or no, he can be specific because he'll record cuts for your area. So he can say, in Los Angeles today, partly cloudy with a high about 68 degrees. Tonight, chance of showers and a low about 43. Then for tomorrow, look for cloudy skies, no sun all day long, and a high only about 65 degrees.
And that would have been a compilation of all these little bits thrown together.
Exactly. And here's some of the magic. If you play a weather bed, a little music bed behind it, mm-hmm. that kind of indicates, you know, some kind of weather bed in the background, mm-hmm. you can't tell. In fact, I used to own some radio stations where we used this guy's voice. Well, we still do, come to think of it. And we get postcards emailed to this guy at our station saying, Tom, don't you ever sleep? When are you going to go on vacation, Tom? So it's possible to assemble and have played on the air audio that is up to the minute accurate, customized for that situation, for your station, and for your area where you are in terms of a weather forecast. And to put this on the air, and you never know that that person's not live in the studio. Well, if you have people who do voice tracking, so what they'll do several hours or a day before, somebody in a studio will real quickly go from cut to cut to cut. They'll listen to the end of this song. They'll say, we've got to think of a couple songs here. Well, that's September Earth, Wind, and Fire here at K104. Glad to have you along with us. We've got music from Madonna coming up and also the Jonas Brothers coming up next on K104. Well, he'll record that. That person might record that, two or three hours in advance or a day in advance, mm-hmm. and that will play at exactly the right time. Now, there's a real interesting science of how do you get all these elements to play together at the right time, the songs and the proper voice tracks, and then the commercials that are paid for. By golly, those have to play. That's the only way the radio station makes a dollar. That's how it pays its bills.
Ah, yes. And now it's not just one radio station, right? So there's a cluster of them. Like the radio station in Los Angeles owns several in Los Angeles and at least a couple in San Diego, for example. And the same voices will appear if you're listening closely.
You're exactly right. The same voices, maybe with different names, maybe the same name, even in different markets. And big companies like Clear Channel and Cumulus have gotten pretty good at this technology, where they can have one person do voice tracking in several markets. Now, I got to tell you, this practice has certainly drawn ire from some listeners or some in the radio business, but it also has it's made it so an operator, somebody who owns a radio station, can have quality talent on the air 24 hours a day. Mm-hmm. And if they do it right, because it has that practice has been abused by some. But if they do it right, it really does sound local and topical. You can talk about the festival coming up this weekend. You can talk about we're giving away tickets, listening to the morning show. They're going to give away some tickets because the morning shows are typically live, happens right then.
Right.
And so I have I got to tell you, there's plenty of radio stations that do this very poorly, and it sounds very canned, almost not this bad, but almost the point of, well, it's a few minutes after the hour. That was a good song. Coming up, we got another great song coming up here at 104. really? Is that the best we could? So this practice of voice tracking is very popular and sometimes appropriate. It's only inappropriate when it's done badly, and it's so easy to do it badly. I'm very fortunate. I'm part owner of some radio stations, and my business partner is really good at getting the right stuff on the air, and so he trains the talent to when they're doing voice tracking. To have topical information. Hey, what's the Rotary Club doing this week? Where are the Girl Scouts doing a cookie sale at? When is this church sponsoring a car wash? And so we'll talk about things that are almost up to the minute. At least they're up to the day part. Up to the within a few hours. And that does work very well. Well, what I was getting at and talking about all these things is there's a log, a program log that has to go into the computer every day. That tells the computer when to play all these things back in what order. And it's interesting that there's a skeleton log that sets the framework for an hour of programming. And then there's information that comes from a couple different places. There's the music log. So the music director will schedule songs to play. And the announcers will be, if they're doing voice tracking, they'll be announcing based upon this music log. Then the program director often, he'll be the one to take the traffic log. Now, the traffic log doesn't have anything to do with green lights and red lights. The traffic log is the log of the commercials and when they need to play. And then these logs get merged together in such a way that the format makes sense, that we don't have an odd commercial sticking out in the middle of nowhere, that we play a cluster of commercials, then we get right back into music. So this is a really interesting science that it's easy to screw up as well, but if you get it right, it works really well. Then there are other there's things that automation systems have to take care of. Like, for example, let's say that you have to – it's common to over-program the hour of music – So you have 60 minutes in an hour. You might have 12 minutes of commercials, and that leaves, what, 48 minutes for music minus a few minutes, two or three minutes for a total for talking during the hour. So you schedule all this stuff and usually end up overscheduling the hour by a song or two. So the automation has to be smart enough to do an update near the top of the hour. Typically, the automation system will say, ooh, I don't have time to play that Avril Lavigne song. So I'm going to drop that Avril Lavigne song and just let this other song, this Madonna song, end. And then we'll play the top of the hour ID, and then we'll go right into the beginning of the next hour. So there's a lot of science involved with all this kind of stuff.
We'll have more with science and the radio. But first, let me thank you for your generosity. This has been such a fun project. And at every step along the way, people have been helpful and really big-hearted. They've rated our show on iTunes, they've told their friends about it, and they've donated money. If you would like to donate to the cause, click on the donate button at whatsitlike.info. Thanks so much. I really appreciate it. So how did you get into radio?
I actually started in television work. When I was in high school, in ninth grade, I knew my father worked at Eastern Kentucky University in Richmond, Kentucky, and they had a television division where students did student production on Wednesday nights. And I was desperately interested in television. I wanted to run a camera. I wanted to maybe run an audio board. I wanted to direct the show. I really wanted to be on the show, but I was in ninth grade. So, and these were college students. So my dad made some arrangements, and I was able to get in and observe for a few weeks. And then after a few weeks, apparently none of the other college students thought running the audio console was very sexy for a TV show. So they let me run the audio console, and I actually kind of did okay with that. And then after a while, they let me run a camera. These were those great big RCA TK-44 cameras that weigh a ton. And then eventually, after I'd worked there for a while, maybe a year, year and a half, they eventually, on a Wednesday night, let me direct. And that was pretty interesting. So I got to say, camera one, two shot, ready one, take one. And so I was the program, the producer, and the technical director. Mm-hmm. At this university, the TV facility for students and the radio station, which is a full power FM, 100,000 watt FM station, they were right next to each other. And I got to tell you, the story's kind of funny. One day, one evening, I was running the audio console at the TV station, and we got done with the TV production, and the door opens from the radio station, and this big, heavy set black guy with a beard and a scraggly afro, he pokes his head in, and he says, hey, you. And I said, yes, sir. He said, come here a second. So I came over there, and he said, listen, can you play some jazz music for a little while? Because I got to go out for a little while. I said, well, yeah, what do I do? He says, well, this board is just like that board over there. And here's the turntable, and here's the other turntable. This is back when we had turntables and records. And I've picked out all the jazz records. So you just go through them, and you play them one by one. I'll be back in a little while. I don't know if he had a date or if he was going to go do some recreational drugs. I have no idea. So maybe he was just hungry. Maybe he was going to go to the student center and get something to eat. So I ran the board for about an hour, and he came back, and we met up every Wednesday for a few more weeks and became friends. And I wish I could remember his name, because he was very influential in my life. So I got interested in this radio thing. And so this university station, it was one of these university stations where they had student volunteers and they had some full-time staff that were paid by the university to work there. They had news programs. The station was WEKU-FM, and it was mostly classical music and some jazz, and then some NPR news in the morning and some news in the evening, with All Things Considered. And so I was I just ran the board. Now, I volunteered to do this. When I worked the shifts that no one else would work, I did the jobs that other Americans were unwilling to do. So I didn't get paid for it. I just thought, this is cool, man. I'm getting to learn how to do this stuff. And after I volunteered there for a year, year and a half, they actually found some grant money, and they were able to pay me a little minimum wage there for a while, which was $2.75 an hour at the time.
So is this one of the boards that had a pot that you had to turn things up and down, and a switch to make things to go from one to the other?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. This was an RCA board. I'm trying to remember the name of it. It had the number 10 in it, I think, because it had 10 audio pots. audio potentiometers. And these were the, they were, you know, round. You turn them just like you were saying. These were actually step attenuators. They actually, when you turn them up, you could feel a little bit of a tick, 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 tick as you turn them, very light. And they actually were not a volume control. They behaved like one, but they actually brought the audio volume up and down in steps of about 3 or 4 decibels, dB. So,
and if you did it smoothly, you could do 2 dials at the same time, make one album come down and the next one come up.
Exactly. Yes, you sure could. And they did have the big lever switch above each each pot. And in this case, it was for putting the audio into the program bus or the audition bus.
My first job was at an AM station in Seattle. So this is old hat to me. As you say, nobody remembers this stuff, but the station was so small that, how small was it? You would go to the window, and I would reach out, and I'd pull up the thermometer, and then I'd walk back to the microphone and tell them what the temperature was.
How about that? There you go. That's how we did it then. And one thing that I noticed, so they let me run the board for different shows running classical music, and this was in a day when at least on my shifts, they didn't let me talk on the air. They had pre-recorded announcements. Even during the classical music, they would have the music director, a gentleman by the name of Loy Lee, and Loy was a drummer, a timpanist in the Cincinnati Orchestra. But Loy would select the classical music, and then he would announce the music, and it would record that on reel-to-reel tape. So he would provide you with a sheet that says, okay, play cut 1, and then play this album cut 3, and then play cut 2, and play this album, you know, cut 5 or something. And so you'd have to follow these directions. Now, the chances of screwing this up were actually pretty high. So I'm sure if he said, and now here's the piece by Johann Sebastian Bach, and I probably played something by Berlioz, you know, or or Saint-Saëns, but it probably wasn't.
As long as something plays, that's the important part.
There you go. Now I got to tell you, there was something that kind of set me apart from the other students there, and I guess was propelling me on a career of eventually engineering and understanding how the stuff worked. Is, for example, they would tell me how to get something or other on the air. Like the station was the flagship station for the EKU football network. And so we had a direct copper line from the radio station over to the stadium. And at the stadium, they'd have an audio mixer and they'd plug it into this line and it would come into a patch panel in the radio station. Now, they told me, okay, Kirk, to get the ball game on the air, you take one of these patch cables and you plug it in this hole, and then you go to the audio console and you take the 5th switch over, you throw it down, you go to the 10th pot and you throw this switch to the right and you turn the pot up and the game will be on the air. I said, well, okay, that's nice, but how does that work? Why am I doing these things? Well, that's just what you do. Well, yeah, but what if that doesn't work? Well, it's going to work. I want to know how that worked. And they just wanted to tell me how to do it. So I cornered the engineer and I got him in there. Don, tell me what I'm doing. They said, plug this thing in. Well, what am I doing when I plug that in? Well, Don took his time to tell me. Well, this hole right here, if you could hear what's at that, if you could take a pair of headphones, and he did, he plugged the headphones in. If they were talking over at the stadium, you'd hear it right here in your headphones. So what you're doing, this other hole they told you to plug this into, this is an input on the audio console. In fact, it's that 5th switch they told you to put down, and you're actually selecting a remote input on the console. So he said, so you're actually connecting the ball, you know, the stadium to the 5th switch input on that console. And I said, why don't you just leave it connected full time? He says, well, we could, but then we wouldn't have that 5th switch available to do something else. Like from the basketball arena, we carried basketball games as well. Or if you had to patch in the news from the TV situation just next door. So he explained the functionality of a patch panel, which nobody else at the radio station understood what it did. They just knew what they had to do. Well, I think this is what sets people apart. You know, students, if you get a job and they tell you how to do something, it's worthwhile to ask, well, not why exactly, but what am I doing when I do that? Mm-hmm. And that way, if something goes wrong, you might be able to troubleshoot it. It turns out one day that switch, that 5th switch on the console, didn't work. It was broken. I don't remember if it was the pot or just what. And I thought, well, maybe there's another input on the console. And sure enough, there was. There were these switches, five or eight of them, and most of them had a remote input on the patch bay. So I patched the ball game into a different input, second or third switch, threw that one down, and then it came through just fine. So, yeah, have a little curiosity about how things work. And, of course, ask somebody who actually knows the answer.
They still have cables you have to plug in here and there?
Some radio stations do. Whether they do or not, it's still the function of a radio station to take audio from various sources, whether it's copper wire pair coming from a football stadium or whether it's music coming out of an automation system, a computer hard drive playback system, or whether it's a microphone like the ones that we're using now, or whether it's a turntable. And they still do use turntables, especially at hip hop stations for the custom live mixes on the air, or whether it's a microphone in a separate studio. There's all these or a CD player, for example. There's all these possibilities for audio sources. And the function of a radio station and the function of an audio mixer would be to bring these sources together, activate them at the appropriate times, mix them together into a program that has a form and a function and a logical sequence from one thing to the next to the next to the next, and mix those things together so that they can then go from the audio console to the transmitter and be put on the air, of course, through some other gear, the audio processing and things like that.
Do they still have the cartridges? The tape cartridges that used to stuff into the little
Very few stations still do use those, but nobody makes that equipment new anymore. Nobody even makes the cartridges new anymore.
So they use computers and MP3 files?
Exactly. And computers now are so inexpensive. And there's even automation programs that allow you to have a central screen could be a touch screen or use your mouse to click on buttons. They even have software now that's free. Absolutely free. Now, I'm not saying the free software is particularly good. I'm not saying it's particularly bad, but there's free software available that runs in Linux. That's a Linux operating system. There's inexpensive software, a couple hundred dollars, $300 or so. And then there's full-blown software that most radio stations use that's up in the $2,000 to $10,000 area that does a lot of things very smoothly. And this audio software, this automation software, can be quite sophisticated in that you can you can use it in a live assist mode to have a live disc jockey and some talent, and then you're hitting buttons to play sound effects and news openings and commercials and then get into to the next song, but the disc jockey is doing a lot of that manually. And then you also have an automation mode where you turn into automation and you get up and when you walk out and the songs play one after another and the jingles play and the commercials play. Of course, all that has to be programmed, and that's often what a program director does is he makes a log of what's going to play.
Well, more with Kirk right after I remind you of the good work being done by St. Jude's. If you like pictures of kids, I got an idea for you. Go to stjude.org and look at the bottom right-hand side of the page. This is the site for St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, and the picture is their patient of the month. Every month you'll see a great picture. They always make me smile. And as long as you're there, click on the donate button. It costs over $1 million a day to operate St. Jude's. I'm not asking you to give the whole amount. I'm just asking you to chip in. So go to St. Jude, stjude.org. I've also added St. Jude's to my Facebook page. After all, how could you not like St. Jude's? How did your parents impact your worldview?
That's a great question. My parents, I was very fortunate. My parents were both terrific people, busy as they could be. They each had, my dad had career. Sometimes my mom had career, and I had three siblings. So, I was always vying for attention, but I was the firstborn. I was always the type A personality, the outgoing guy, the guy that I don't really need my parents' advice. I'm going to go out and do my own stuff. So I was working at the age of 15. My mom had to pick me up from the radio station. In fact, after I worked at the public station for a couple of years, I got a job at a commercial station. It was WEKY. It was an AM station. We played, it was back in the disco era. This was, 78, 79. We're playing the Bee Gees. We're playing Donna Summer, Peaches and Herb. And so, you kids go look in the in your archives and you may find this in your history books.
Oldies, yes.
Nobody heard of Madonna yet. So, and now she's old hat. So I worked there, and in fact, I I can't remember. Oh, I would get a ride from somebody from school because this I couldn't drive yet. I was 15. And my mother worked at a hospital. She was a nurse. And after her shift ended at midnight, she would come and pick me up at the radio station. So about 12:15, and the station would go off the air at midnight. So that worked out fine back in the days when stations actually went off the air because nobody listened that night. Everybody was sleeping.
That's true. Well, with all this working, was school a challenge for you?
You know, I found school to be pretty easy. I was one of those students that my secret in school was I paid attention in class. I did my homework in class. I almost never had homework to take home. I did my work in class. Part of it was luck. I happened to get teachers that didn't assign a lot of homework. I rarely had to do work at home for school. I was one of those kids that some kids hated because I was smart and I you know, the administrators liked me.
Well, now that you've survived childhood, what constitutes family for you?
Actually, my career and my personality have culminated into what has been a rocky marriage relationships for me. It's taken four. I believe in marriage. I'm a firm believer in marriage. I believe in so much. I've been married four times.
Oh my!
So I have a wife now who also has been married a few times, and I wish I'd met her, you know, when I was in high school, because we're just perfect for each other. She supports my radio habit. I'm no longer full-time in the radio business. I'm part owner of some stations, and I still do engineering work for those stations. See, my love was engineering. You know, I love being on the air, and I can talk about that all day long. But honestly, even though I was excited, enthusiastic about being a presenter, being on the air, being a disc jockey, you know, in high school, I was always asked to, hey, would you MC the snowball dance? Or would you MC the, you know, this or that dance? Or would you MC this award ceremony? Yeah, I'll do it. I mean, I wasn't not saying I was any good at it, stumble bumbled around, but I was at least a kid who would stand up and do it. But even though I had that outgoingness in my personality, I never was really all that good on the air. I mean, I would never have grown into a major.
You wouldn't have made it big in radio as an announcer or personality?
I say that. I don't know. You know, actually, later in life, here I am. I'm almost 50 years old. And now I feel pretty well connected politically. I understand, you know, the news and news cycles, and I think I actually have some insight on what's going on in the world. As a 20-year-old, as a 25-year-old, I don't think you've got much to offer a big audience of people. I could be wrong, and there are certainly could be exceptions to that.
Is talk radio the place for big personalities?
Well, that's certainly one of the last places. That there are big personalities in terms of guys like Rick Dees or Ryan Seacrest, people like that. Mm-hmm. And there are plenty of other such talent across the country. They just come to mind first. And these guys have made a career out of the music and knowing the personalities and being in big stations where they can do artist interviews and such as that. You know, it used to be back before the internet came along, there were a lot more music station personalities on the air. In fact, one of the guys that I work with is a fellow named Denny Sanders. And outside of Ohio, or New York, a lot of folks may not know who Denny Sanders is. Well, Denny's now in the Ohio Broadcasting Hall of Fame. You can find old YouTube clips of him on YouTube, old video clips. And he has interviewed rock artist after artist after artist after artist. I mean, he knows these people and can tell you stories that just go on and on. And I was talking to Denny a couple days ago. He was telling me about in Cleveland, Ohio. You remember an actor named Jim Backus?
Oh yes.
Yeah, it was the voice of Mr. Magoo.
Yes.
And he was also Thurston Howell III on Gilligan's Island.
That's right.
Well, Jim Backus was a morning disc jockey on a radio station in Cleveland, Ohio. And Denny's got stories about Jim Backus. The station was located in the Statler Hotel in downtown Cleveland. So there's all kinds of, there's stories like this. Another guy that I work with does audio processing work, and he's good personal friends with Scott Shannon of the famous pirate radio days and the Z100 days in New York back in the 80s, the station that went from worst to first in 3 months. You do end up, but back to your question, I'm getting a little older. My wife's just started listening to talk radio. She finds that more stimulating than music radio nowadays. Sure, we have our iPods, and you know, we get tired of the political talk and what people are chatting about. We will, you know, go back to listening to our favorite song from the 80s. But I think it does take some maturity in an individual to have something to offer on the air. Let me hearken back to what I was talking about, the first job that I had at WEKU, that public radio station. You know, the best people who were working on the air, the best people doing news, the best people doing interviews, and the best people who were actually just announcing music, were not the broadcasting majors.
Mm-hmm.
It was people majoring in political science or history or English or anything but broadcasting. It's because you don't have to, I guarantee you, the top people in, I can't guarantee it, but I will bet you dollars to donuts that Rick Dees, Ryan Seacrest, and now let's pick some talk people, Dr. Laura, Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, Ed Schultz, Neil Bortz, people like this, they didn't go to broadcasting school.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not saying there's something wrong with broadcasting school. I'm just saying that broadcasting school will get you a lot of, you know, technical info, technical knowledge, and things that you can use to make a career. But if you want to be interesting to people, if you want to be a talent, it's going to take more than just knowing how to run the audio console.
What's the best thing about your job?
Oh, golly. You know, I haven't really talked about my job, have I? My job is I work for a company that makes broadcast equipment now. I work for Telos. And they make systems to put callers on the air on radio stations. They make audio processing, and they make mixers. You know, they make audio consoles for radio mm-hmm. stations.
If I were doing a radio show from my house, I would have to have a Telos connection between me and the real radio station.
I think you'd have to have one. Now, there are several competitors out there that also make fine equipment that will do the same thing. But sure, Telos will make stuff that does a great job. What I like about my job is because I've got some experience in being on the air. And, you know, that was not time wasted. That wasn't my final career, but that wasn't time wasted because mm-hmm. now I can relate to people who are on the air. Also, I can relate to their bosses. And because I did engineering for years, I'm self-taught. I didn't go to engineering school. I read manuals. Truth is, I got shocked a few times. I know where the electrons all hang out inside the equipment, right? And so I self-taught engineering, did that for a few years. You ever heard the phrase, fake it till you make it?
Ah, yes.
Well, I tell you what, that's, you know,
good advice.
I think, you know, school is great. It's worthwhile. You need it to get you pointed in the right direction. But there's plenty of things that any school, even a university, can't teach you. You've got to you've got to have a burning desire to learn something.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell you, if you're in a course of study and you don't have a burning desire to learn it, well, you're probably doing the wrong thing. Maybe you need to, you know, figure out what it is that you want out of life.
What has surprised you about your job?
Oh, golly, what has surprised me about my what has surprised me is that the company that I work for is appreciative of whatever my talents seem to be. I work my tush off, you know, just doing things for the company. And actually, I've been able to find a job, and I really hope that people that you talk to get to do this as well. Sometimes people give advice, and they say, do whatever you're passionate about, and the money will come,
mm-hmm.
or at least the satisfaction will come, and enough money to live on. And I really believe that. I mean, radio is not the most lucrative business in the world. And if I wanted to sell broadcast equipment, which is what I do now, I represent a company and I help sell broadcast equipment to broadcasters. But the weird thing is, I don't consider myself a salesman. Not there's anything wrong with that. I consider myself an educator. I mean, a really excited, motivated, turned on, eager educator.
Mm-hmm.
And I educate people about what our products do. And they go, yeah, that's pretty cool. I need that. And they buy them. So, you know, my job title is executive director of sales for Telos, Omnia, and Axia. And I swear, I don't think I've done any sales in my life. I just tell people about why I think this is really cool. And I don't try to say you ought to think it's cool too. I think I just understand how the thing works and it might do you some good.
Everyone has to give themselves motivation occasionally. How do you give yourself a kick in the pants?
That's a great question. You know, The job I have now involves dealing with people a lot and motivating people. And sometimes I would just rather work with a piece of equipment than people, because people are unpredictable, and people sometimes, even oftentimes, don't do what you want them to do. And so there's a couple things that I do for motivation. And I don't do as much as I used to, but I'll listen to music that I like really, really loud. You know, and I'll make sure that nobody can see in my office window, and I will actually get up and dance around the office, or I'll grab a couple of pens and make like I'm a drummer. Every disc jockey in the world has got has two pens that they drum on the console with. You know, every disc jockey is a drummer or a singer. They'll grab the microphone. But I haven't seen too much of that. Most disc jockeys are drummers. I'm surprised I haven't been caught speeding more than I have, because, you know, if in my earlier in my career, I was an engineer that traveled. I was a contract engineer. And I lived most of the time I did this, I lived in Memphis, Tennessee, and I would drive all over West Tennessee and Eastern Arkansas and North Mississippi and even into Kentucky and Missouri. And I would fix broken radio stations. So I was on call. I had 100 clients and had a couple employees. The point is I had a lot of time to drive. Well, driving is a good time to think. And so sometimes I turn the radio off, and back in the days of a cassette player, we didn't have iPods then. And I'd turn that off, and I'd think, and I'd work a problem out in my head and get that. When I was done with that, or when I was tired of working on a problem, I'd crank the music up. And I think the best era for music that's motivational was the 1980s, you know, like that song Walking on Sunshine by Katrina and the Waves. I mean, if you listen to that song and you don't end up going, yeah, man, I'm excited. Woo! Well, there's something wrong with you. You need to check your temperature. In short, to get motivated, I do something that I like. And sometimes it's being alone and fixing something or learning about something. I have this insatiable desire to learn. I read Wikipedia, for crying out loud.
And when you need to soothe yourself, how do you calm yourself down?
I don't know that I ever. I guess occasionally I actually watch TV. Mm-hmm. Our family, right now, we've got a little tradition going. The whole family, me and my wife and our daughter. I've got three daughters who are grown from my first marriage. They're all off and married themselves. So at home, we got wife, daughter, and a newborn son. But we watch Castle, you know, the ABC TV show Castle.
Oh, yeah.
We love that show. So it's so dramatic. and so we watch that. And that's about all the TV I can take every day, though.
Well, I would be remiss if I didn't mention your podcast. How did you get into that?
You know, this is a great question. A few years ago, there was a television network on cable called Tech TV. This is a network for geeks. I mean, this was great. They talked about computers and online gaming and just all this cool stuff. So
this is Paul Allen's little project.
Yes, Paul Allen and Vulcan Ventures owned this thing. Well, it was very expensive, and they never did make any money. But one of the characters on that was a guy named Leo Laporte. Mm-hmm. And I sure enjoyed Leo. He did a show called The Screensavers. And he also did a show called Call for Help. Well, long story short, I never got to meet Leo until recently. I actually showed up one time at the Tech TV network when I was early in the days working for Telos. I went to San Francisco, saw some clients, and made an appointment at Tech TV. I said, I'd like to come on the Screensavers and explain how MP3 works. Explain it with a little bit of technical detail, because the company I worked for, Telos, was the very first company in the world to license MP3 from the company that invented it, Fraunhofer, in Germany. And there's a whole story behind that we don't have time for. But so I talked to a producer at Tech TV, and by the way, at the time I was doing some TV weather. I had this interest in being a TV weatherman, and so I told people I didn't like school all that much. I did well in it, but I never went to college until later in life. I wanted to be a meteorologist. I thought, well, I better get a little degree in this. So I actually paid for 3 years of my own college education and got a degree in meteorology from Mississippi State University. Well, anyway, back to the story. So I always thought there ought to be a podcast for radio engineers as a place that they can listen, get information, maybe participate in. But how am I going to get this advertised out to people? So A couple of years ago, we sold some equipment to Leo at his twit.tv network, the Twit network. It's an audio console. Mm-hmm. And I went there. I said, hey, I'll go install it for free, man, because I want to meet Leo. So I did that. I worked there for about 4 or 5 days. I gained some confidence from Leo, told him my dream of having a podcast. And he said, well, okay, we'll put it on the Twit network. Now, Leo's the big idea guy. He's the guy that says yes to lots of ideas, but he had a gatekeeper, the guy who ran the company, a fellow named Dane. Dane didn't say yes to everything. So Dane said, Kirk, you do a few episodes first and then come back and talk. Because he wanted to make sure I wasn't just going to do a few episodes and quit.
Right.
So we did 20 episodes, so 20 weeks, and then it came to pass that we were able to get the show on the Twit network. So then we did about another year, a little over a year's worth of shows, and we weren't really a Twit show. We were just, they accommodated us. They let us on their network, but we weren't on their website. So by just nose to the grindstone, trying to do a good show every Wednesday night, and being reliable about it and showing them that we're serious, they said, you know what? How'd you like to be part of the Twit family?
Wasn't that nice?
So, yeah, I'm a very appreciative of them. They've brought more to me than I've brought to them. I've brought them a couple thousand listeners and viewers, but I'm really glad to be associated with them and glad they have some faith in what we're doing.
Is there an event in your life that has challenged you to the core?
Well, yeah. It's been several, and they've all been marriages. I think I'm a real type A personality, and I love what I do a lot, and that can get in the way of a relationship. So, here's the philosophy that I was wrong about for so long. Because I was an engineer, I could fix anything. I could, here's the attitude I had about that. Even though I didn't understand all about electronics, I knew that, for example, this transmitter, this FM transmitter that wasn't working that I was looking at trying to fix, I knew that, look, a human being invented this thing and designed it. And it's not beyond my capability of understanding it, at least enough to not redesign it, but at least enough to put it back the way it was the day it came out of the factory. And as an engineer, that's pretty much been my goal when I'm repairing something that's broken. Just make it the way it was the day it came out of the factory. If there's parts that are worn out, mechanical parts, replace them. If you can rejuvenate them in some way, like a rubber pinch roller, and you can make it fresh and new, do that by applying a chemical or cleaning it. If something needs to be lubricated, do that. If there's an electrolytic capacitor, which is an electronic part inside, that has dried out and become no good anymore, well, we'll replace that. If there's a dirty connector that just needs to be cleaned like the day that it came out of the factory, clean it. And you know what? That philosophy served me very, very well. Well, the fact that I could fix about anything also led me to believe that if I met somebody and fell in love and decided to get married, if there's something I didn't like about them, well, I could fix that. Well, that's pretty foolhardy, isn't it? So that philosophy of extending my work into a personal relationship, that didn't work out too well. So after three failed attempts, I finally figured out, you know what? I just need to not jump into the first relationship I come across. I need to sort this thing out. Just be cool for a while. And so anyway, I ended up meeting somebody who's very like-minded to me.
If you were giving a commencement address for high school or college graduation, what would be your best advice? What would you say?
The world doesn't owe you anything. And this is tough for people to hear, but you as an individual, you don't have a right to anybody else's time, talent, money, assets. You don't have a right to any of that. You're welcome to ask for it. But if you are on the public dole, if you expect that somebody else is going to take care of you, not because you asked them to, but because the government gave you something, I got to tell you, you have your hand in my pocket. Now, I believe in charity, and I'm absolutely willing to help somebody out who asks, but I'm really not very excited about, you know, a society where I'm required to give with a threat of jail. I'm required to give, and somebody else is going to take that. Now, I know that as a society, we all have to live together and do things together, like build roads and defend where we live against people who want to, you know, take what we have. And again, I do believe in charity very much, but I think that you ought to live your life with the feeling that you don't have a right to something that somebody else has worked for.
I want to thank Kirk Harnack for joining me today. Thanks, Kirk. I really appreciate it.
Ken, thank you for letting me spout off. I appreciate it, and don't edit this too heavily. And I don't know. I don't know so many students today, but I tell you what, you've got to get enthused about whatever it is that you're going to do, and you may not know what to get enthused about. So you just got to try a lot of stuff.